Oh, why did I have to fall in love with such a fool?
I ran into a story for you, a front page story.
Gus, you're a dear, sweet boy, and you'll bring my little present.
You're listening to The Pictures Got Small, an appreciation podcast for the glamorous and sometimes dark history of old Hollywood. Hosted by Francesca Luisi.
I happen to know the police are looking for this car.
Oh, dear, I hoped you wouldn't.
You heard me say no, didn't you? Well, that's what I mean.
See here. I told you I wasn't asking anything from anybody. I can take care of myself.
Maybe you have, but if you think I want to stay cooped up in this place any longer than I have to...
This is one of the biggest stories that's cracked in a long time. I've simply got to get it to my paper.
No worry about that. We've got all the time in the world.
Okay, welcome to the Pictures Got Small podcast. My name is Francesca, coming at you from the floor of my closet, and I will be your host. If you don't know, the Pictures Got Small actually started out as an Instagram page that I run, where I share Hollywood trivia that I find interesting and just the little tidbits that I like to learn about movies. I always say that I am full of totally useless movie knowledge that never comes up in conversation, that I never get to talk about, and that I have absolutely nothing to do with. And it was only recently that I realized it was only useless because I wasn't doing anything with it. And that's what gave me the idea to start The Pictures Got Small. I knew I wanted to turn it into a podcast at some point to further discuss some of these stories that I feel like warranted more than just an Instagram post. So I took a look at my Instagram feed and I noticed that a post I did about Some Like It Hot is my most liked so far. I think as of this recording, it has 3,500 likes, maybe even more than that by now. And I figured since people still love this movie so much and they're so interested in it, this might be a great place to start the show. So if you will let me, I would like to tell you the story of the making of this comedy classic. Also, this is the third time that I'm recording this. Not because there's anything wrong with the first two takes, other than I think you could hear my dog snoring in the background of one of them. But I felt like I needed to find my voice. I felt like I didn't sound like me, like I was trying way too hard to sound professional and no nonsense. And that's just not me. And let's just get it out of the way. I am fully aware that I have a New York accent. I tried my best to speak slowly and clearly. My whole life I've been told that I talk too fast, so I really tried. So hopefully you guys will be able to understand me. The script for this, for the most part, is pretty clean, but there are, I think, two curse words in there somewhere. So if you are minor or listening to this in the company of minors, don't say I didn't warn you. Okay, so with that said, let's get into it. Here is the story of the making of Some Like It Hot. In September 1957, brothers Walter, Howard, and Marvin Mirisch of the newly formed production company, the Mirisch Company, approached famed director Billy Wilder about making a film for them, as they had just signed a 12-picture deal with United Artists. Wilder was already a Hollywood legend by this point. He had made classic films Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Sabrina, and The 7-Year Itch, and won 3 out of 10 Academy Award nominations. Best Director and Best Screenwriting for 1945's The Lost Weekend, and a second Best Screenwriting Award for Sunset Boulevard. Wilder wanted to remake a German film, 1951's Fanfare de Liebe, or Fanfares of Love, which was a remake of the 1935 French comedy Fanfare d'Amour. Both films follow a duo of down-on-their-luck male characters looking for any way to make money during the Great Depression, one of which being a scheme where they cross-dress and join an all-female band. But this was Eisenhower's America, and Billy Wilder knew that puritanical American audiences would not find poverty, with the unemployment rate at just 5.2% in 1957, as a good enough reason for two young, strapping, heterosexual men to don women's clothing. Wilder felt that to keep the audience on his side, he would have to break it down to a matter of life and death. After throwing around several ideas, Wilder and his writing partner, I.A.L. Diamond, eventually came up with the idea of having the characters witness the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the brutal 1929 gangland killing in Chicago. Audiences would understand the characters' need to escape the mob by any means necessary, even if it meant throwing on some dresses and pumps. Years later, Billy Wilder would recall the story of when he first told Big Shot producer David O. Selznick about the film that was to become Some Like It Hot. I told him a little about the film, and he said, "The Valentine's Day Murder?" And I said, "Yes, that's in the beginning." He looked at me and said, "You're crazy. You mean real machine guns and blood in a comedy?" I said, "Why not?" He says, "Total failure. They're going to walk out in droves." He was wrong. More on the public's reception of the film later. Wilder, an Austrian Jew who fled Europe during the rise of the Nazi Party, learned to speak English by listening to jazz records. With the St. Valentine's Day Massacre putting his script in 1920 Chicago, Wilder was happy to craft a story set in the age of jazz. The title of the film also derives from the era. Popular songs of the day were released in two versions, a standard known as sweet music, and a second jazz version called hot. Those who did not embrace jazz music could enjoy the sweet cut of the song, while some did, in fact, like their music hot. The film tells the story of two screwball jazz musicians who, after being in the wrong place at the wrong time, witness the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and now have to escape the Chicago mob. They hear about Sweet Sue and her Society Syncopators, a traveling all-girl band that is leaving on a train to Miami to perform a show, and out of options, they dress and drag to escape to safety. While in hiding as women, both men find themselves in romantic dilemmas. Joe, a sax player, falls for the lead singer of the band, but can't afford to blow his cover, while Jerry, on bass, is pursued by a rich suitor who pulls out all the stops to earn the affection of the object of his desire. In addition to being a gender-bending comedy of errors, Some Like It Hot would harken back to the classic gangster films of the 1930s, a likeness that Billy Wilder set out to make when he cast veteran actor George Raft as top wise guy Spats Columbo. In one scene at the end of the film, Raft observes a young hood played by Edward G. Robinson Jr., son of the Little Caesar star with which he shared a name, flipping a coin up in the air. "Where'd you learn that cheap trick?" Raft quips. The scene is a nod to one of Raft's earlier career-making roles in 1932's Scarface, where his character performed the same coin toss. In another scene, Spat smashes a grapefruit into the face of one of his henchmen, a throwback to a moment from 1939's The Public Enemy with James Cagney. The ingenious script, penned by Wilder and Diamond, also toys with the time period. When we first meet Jerry and Joe, the latter chastises Jerry for being pessimistic. Suppose the stock market crashes. Suppose Mary Pickford divorces Douglas Fairbanks. Suppose the Dodgers leave Brooklyn. Suppose Lake Michigan overflows. You don't need me to tell you that these events all actually happened either during or after 1929. It offers a look at the innocence of the time period. The Wall Street crash that would occur in September of that year would kickstart the Great Depression, sending millions into poverty. The film allows us to have a look at what the last leg of the Roaring Twenties, the era of Gatsby, jazz, prohibition, and flappers, may have been like in its glory days. By the time of the film's casting, Tony Curtis was already a bona fide movie star, having just starred alongside Sidney Poitier in 1958's The Defiant Ones, which earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor, in addition to 8 other nominations for the film. Wilder first noticed the actor when he starred in the 1953 biopic Houdini, and felt that Curtis would be perfect for his latest project. Aside from Tony Curtis, Billy Wilder had initially planned to cast Frank Sinatra as the second male lead. When Old Blue Eyes did not show up to their lunch date, Wilder withdrew him from consideration, briefly entertaining the idea of casting Danny Kaye or Jerry Lewis instead. That was until Wilder spotted up-and-comer Jack Lemmon in 1957's Operation Madball. Then he knew he had found the right man for the job. The studio, however, had reservations. United Artists was happy with the casting of Tony Curtis, but felt that they needed another big name to help carry the film, and Jack Lemmon was not there yet. Lemon had mostly worked on television and had a part in 1958's Bell, Book, and Candle with Kim Novak and Jimmy Stewart, in addition to Operation Madball, but was hardly the caliber of star that would fill movie theaters. If Wilder could get another big star attached to the film, United Artists would give him the green light to cast Lemon. This threw a wrench in Wilder's plans. Not only did he really want to work with Lemon, but he had intended to cast actress Mitzi Gaynor in the role of Sugar Cane, the lead singer of the female band and Tony Curtis's love interest. It was then that Wilder received a telegram from an actress he had worked with a few years earlier, Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn wrote to Billy expressing her interest in working with him again after he directed her in 1955's The 7-Year Itch, the film most notable for the iconic scene where the skirt of Marilyn's white dress is blown up by the breeze from a subway grate. Marilyn Monroe was by then the leading sex symbol in Hollywood, having taken the mantle in 1953 when she had 3 major theatrical releases come out all in the same year: Niagara, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and How to Marry a Millionaire. Not long after finishing The 7-Year Itch with Wilder, she started her own company, Marilyn Monroe Productions, with her friend and photographer-slash-business partner Milton Green, and had been studying method acting with famed coach Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio in New York City. Later that year, 20th Century Fox renegotiated her contract, increasing her salary and allowing her more control over her projects. Though she sang his praises in her telegram, Wilder was not keen on working with Marilyn again after the disastrous production of The 7-Year Itch, where Marilyn's now infamous tardiness and delays led to problems on the set. Marilyn, on the other hand, desperately needed both money and a distraction. 1957, the year before Some Like It Hot went into production, was tumultuous for her. Her husband, famed Death of a Salesman playwright Arthur Miller, was charged and found guilty of contempt towards Congress for refusing to give names to the House Un-American Activities Committee during the Communist Red Scare of the 1950s. When he was initially asked by the court to provide names, Miller had said, "I could not use the name of another person and bring trouble on him." His trial, in which he pled not guilty and would refuse to testify, concluded with Miller being fined $500 and given a 1-year suspended sentence. He and his legal team had moved to appeal the court's verdict. That same year, Marilyn dissolved her partnership with Milton Green, buying out his share of Marilyn Monroe Productions for $100,000, claiming that he had poorly managed the company. Arthur Miller succeeded him as vice president. The purchase, combined with Miller's mounting legal fees, was adding to the increasing financial strain on the couple. In June, the only film Marilyn was a part of that year, The Prince and the Showgirl, was released to lukewarm reviews. Critics were favorable to her performance and were quick to mention that she outshined her Academy Award-winning leading man/director, Sir Laurence Olivier. This was the first film where Marilyn received a percentage of the profits. Of the $1.6 million box office, she earned a 10% commission of $160,000. Despite needing the funds, Marilyn donated $32,000 to the Free Milk Fund for Babies, an organization that provided free milk to New York City's poor. Marilyn was actually not eager to go back to work at this time, as she and Arthur were trying to start a family. In fact, it was in 1957 that Marilyn found out that she was pregnant. She so desperately wanted to be a mother. But since renegotiating her contract with Fox in 1955, Marilyn had only made one film for them, 1956's Bus Stop. The Prince and the Showgirl had been distributed by Warner Brothers and therefore did not count towards the 3 pictures she still owed Fox. The studio had been trying to lock Marilyn into The Blue Angel with Spencer Tracy, who insisted on top billing. Marilyn agreed to the picture, but continuously flaked on business meetings, and it eventually fell through. On August 1st, while doing some gardening at the home she and Arthur shared in Connecticut, Marilyn was rushed to the hospital with violent stomach pains. She suffered an ectopic pregnancy. The fertilized egg was not growing in her uterus where it would survive, but in her fallopian tube. In order to save her life, the pregnancy had to be terminated. She remained in the hospital for 10 days after the procedure, sinking deep into a depression, blaming herself for what happened. Eager to lift his wife's spirits, Arthur Miller thought a good role would help Marilyn out of her depression. He knew how badly she wanted to be taken seriously as an actress and began adapting his short story, The Misfits, into a screenplay. It would be another few years before the film was made, and Arthur kept his eyes open for career opportunities for his wife. By the end of the year, Marilyn had not come any closer to making the second of the four films she owed the studio. By the start of 1958, Marilyn's depression had worsened. She feared that she was a failure as a wife and a partner, but also as an actress. Her professional absence contributed to her downward spiral, and she was relying heavily on champagne and barbiturates. It was in April that she learned of Billy Wilder's new film from Arthur Miller, who had heard about the script and encouraged her to pursue the role of Sugar. By this time, Marilyn had been fighting for years to be taken seriously in Hollywood, pushing back against the dumb blonde roles that had both typecasted her and made her a star. The role of Sugar Cane would be a departure from her crusade to become a dramatic actress, as she would once again be playing into the gold-digging dumb blonde stereotype. But the Millers needed the money, and Marilyn needed to get out of her own head. Marilyn sent her desperate telegram to Billy. United Artists was thrilled and urged Wilder to cast her. With a huge box office draw like Marilyn Monroe attached to the film, it would not only free up Wilder to cast Jack Lemmon, but guarantee ticket sales. Her inclusion in the film wouldn't count as one of the pictures she had to make for Fox since it was being produced by United Artists, but Marilyn's home studio was in favor of her doing the movie. Since they wouldn't be directly involved in the production, they wouldn't be on the line for any of the costly delays Marilyn was bound to incur. And if the movie did well, it would reflect positively on Fox and generate good publicity for them as well. It would also put Fox in the position to eventually dangle the carrot of unfulfilled contract obligations over Marilyn's head. Wilder relented, offering the role of Sugar Cane to Marilyn. She officially signed on to Some Like It Hot on April 28, 1958, agreeing to a salary of $200,000 plus 10% of the box office once the film grossed $4 million. Marilyn would even get top billing, which annoyed Tony Curtis, who asked that the size of his name be made larger in the credits to compensate for his not being billed first. Of this insane demand, Wilder reportedly told Curtis, "The trouble with you, Tony, is that you were only interested in little pants and big letters." This retort was a jab at Curtis's strange penchant for wearing tight pants. Side note, I rewatched the film in preparation for this episode, and Tony Curtis's name doesn't look any larger than Marilyn's or Jack Lemmon's. So I guess that tells us what became of this argument. With Marilyn on board, Billy Wilder was finally able to cast Jack Lemmon. When he offered him the role, Wilder told Lemmon, "If you take the part, you're going to be in drag for 85% of the picture. Do you want to do it?" In a 2001 interview, Lemmon recalled, "I thought about it for 2 split seconds, and then I said yes." When Lemmon's wife asked him why he would agree to do a picture before seeing the script, Lemmon told her, "Because it's Billy Wilder." Lemmon said that he remembered receiving the first 60 pages of the script in the mail and laughed so hard that at one point he fell off of his couch. When he phoned Wilder to tell him that the script was the funniest 60 pages he had ever read, the director said that they would write the rest as they went along because it would, quote, "give them something to do." Marilyn's costumes were being made by famed wardrobe designer Ori Kelly, who had worked on notable films such as Casablanca, Arsenic and Old Lace, The Maltese Falcon, Now Voyager, and An American in Paris. Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, however, were told to pick their costumes off of the racks in MGM's wardrobe department. They went to Wilder and asked that their costumes be made by Ori Kelly as well, and the director agreed. During a wardrobe fitting in which Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, and Marilyn Monroe were being measured by Kelly for their costumes, The designer quipped to Marilyn that Curtis had a bigger derriere than she did. Marilyn, who was wearing just stockings and a button-up blouse, undid her shirt and pulled it open, declaring, "But he doesn't have tits like these." Of the makeup and costume, Tony Curtis later recalled, "We were doing great until we started to dress up like women. I got really nervous. I didn't like it. I felt awkward." Billy Wilder would laugh himself silly as soon as I came out. Very prim, very proper, very made up. Beautiful, but very aloof. Jack Lemmon, on the other hand, was like a $3 pretzel. He just loved the idea to dress up in women's clothes and prance around. To their credit, the constant in and out of drag that both Curtis and Lemmon managed to pull off elevates their cross-dressing to an art form. The punchline isn't so much about seeing two men in dresses, but rather on their teetering between genders while trying not to get caught. "The men's stuff was easy," Tony Curtis would recall decades later. "It was the ladies' stuff that had me worried. We had our legs and chests shaved, our eyebrows plucked, hips padded. To find the appropriate bra was no easy matter. I'm a 36D myself." Marilyn's film contract stipulated that all of her movies be shot in color, but Billy Wilder had decided that Some Like It Hot would be in black and white. He convinced both Marilyn Monroe and the Mirisch brothers that the bright movie lights distorted the heavy makeup on Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, making them look ghoulish on camera. If they were going to sell the audience on the idea that the two male leads were successfully passing as members of the opposite sex, then they had to look convincing as women. Both Marilyn and the Mirisches agreed with Wilder and did not push for the film to be shot in color, whether or not his story about their makeup was true. When they put on their makeup and costumes for the very first time, Tony Curtis was so nervous that he recalled being unable to step out of the wardrobe trailer. Jack Lemmon went first and, according to Curtis, was like a 20-cent tart, acting very bubbly and ditzy. Seeing Lemmon's approach, Tony knew that he had to act the opposite to balance out their performances. "I had to be a lady," Curtis said, "very grand, like my mother or Grace Kelly." Before heading to the set, Jack Lemmon wanted to walk around the lot with Tony Curtis to see what, if any, reaction they would get. Curtis suggested that they go to the ladies' room instead. They took a trip to the studio commissary and entered the women's restroom, where they pretended to touch up their makeup while chatting in phony voices. Women came and went, and as Jack Lemmon remembered, not a single one batted an eyeball. The ruse convinced the actors that they made believable women, after all. The studio hired female impersonator Barbette to teach Lemmon and Curtis how to walk and move more convincingly as women, but they declined his services. They decided that it would be best for their characters if they moved awkwardly, as it would lend itself in reminding the audience that these were two men disguised as women. Shooting began in August at MGM Studios in Hollywood. The first scene to be filmed was at the train station, where the all-girl band is boarding the train from Chicago to Miami. The first time we see Marilyn as Sugarcane, she is sauntering down the platform looking for her bandmates. With the camera trained on her backside, a puff of smoke emanates from the train, followed by two successive blows of the horn, startling her. She jumps in her black stilettos, looking over her shoulder at the offending smoke. Her body, as Jack Lemmon quips his bass player Jerry in full drag, is like jello on springs. During the filming of this scene, Marilyn never took her eyes off of her acting coach, Paula Strasberg, who stood watching off camera. Paula was the wife of Lee Strasberg, Marilyn's teacher from the actor's studio. In the years since she began her studies, Marilyn had come to rely entirely on Paula's approval. After each take, if Paula nodded her head in a silent no, Marilyn would request that the scene be reshot until Paula was satisfied, whether or not Billy Wilder felt the same way. After one of the many takes, when Wilder called cut, he turned to Strasberg and asked, "How was that for you, Paula?" Strasberg reportedly shrank back in embarrassment and never inserted herself again for the duration of the picture. Paula Strasberg aside, the beginning of the shoot started out well. During the filming of the scene where all of the girls from the band crowd into Jack Lemmon's bunk, Billy Wilder laughed so hard that he ruined the take and they had to stop rolling. Wilder had even praised Marilyn's professionalism to the press, mentioning that on at least one occasion, she had showed up on set hours before her call time. For Marilyn's Runnin' Wild song and dance number, choreographer Jack Cole stood behind the camera, doing the dance himself. Marilyn watched Cole the entire time and mimicked him while the camera rolled. In an unconfirmed rumor, it was said that Sugar was made a ukulele player because the small instrument would draw attention to the size of Marilyn's breasts. Whether or not this is true, it is worth mentioning that in the theatrical trailer for the film, which would be released months later, the credits list Marilyn Monroe and her two bosom companions. Sugar even has a line in the film where she says to Lemon's Daphne, "What I envy about you is that you're so flat-chested." Within days of the start of the production, Arthur Miller won his appeal. The contempt charges were dropped and his case was officially closed. Things were starting to look up for Marilyn. On September 11, 1958, the shoot moved to Coronado, California to film the exterior shots of the hotel and the scenes at the beach. Everyone was in good spirits during this shoot. The only setback was that the set was near a military base, and airplanes were constantly taking off and ruining the sound, and they soon found themselves trying to squeeze in takes between the departures. Arthur Miller came down to join his wife on location, and Marilyn was in rare form. She would be on her best behavior for the duration of the exterior shoot, but this was to be short-lived. Not long after Miller's arrival, Marilyn learned that she was pregnant again and immediately grew fearful of another miscarriage. Miller informed Billy Wilder, asking the director to go easy on his wife so as not to put any undue pressure on her. When he asked Wilder if Marilyn could leave the set each day at 4:30 p.m., Wilder replied, "I'll tell you something. If you bring her at 9 a.m. ready to shoot, I won't let her go at 4:30, but at noon." When the production moved back to the studio for the interior scenes, Marilyn's anxieties started to get the best of her. A relaxation exercise Strasberg taught Marilyn became more of a warm-up for her during this time. Whenever she was getting ready to perform, she would shake her hands quickly from side to side as if she were drying nail polish. She grew self-conscious about her fluctuating weight, fully aware of the emphasis that would be made on her figure throughout the course of the film. She would often flub her lines, requiring even more takes than she usually requested, which put pressure on Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon to be perfect every time, as they never knew when Marilyn was going to nail her dialogue. The two had even taken to making bets as to how many takes they thought Marilyn was going to require. Reportedly, after each take, Marilyn would call out, "Coffee," and was brought a thermos that contained a vermouth. The black-clad Paula Strasberg shadowed Marilyn, sometimes literally. She was often seen holding an umbrella over her star pupil's head. There were days when Marilyn would arrive on set late and keep the cast and crew waiting several hours before she came out of her trailer. Then, there were days when she didn't show up at all. On more than one occasion, Curtis and Lemon had to soak their feet, which would swell after they stood around in uncomfortable high heels for hours waiting for Marilyn. Years later, Billy Wilder would say of the start of Marilyn's professional decline while making the picture, "I knew we were in mid-flight and there was a nut on the plane." Marilyn's fragile mental state was not a secret. She'd become known for her tardiness and lateness dating as far back as the early 50s, and her substance abuse issues were already in full swing. It is said that Marilyn's alcohol and pill consumption worsened during the making of The Prince and the Showgirl, when Marilyn, only recently married to Arthur Miller, discovered a disparaging journal entry he'd written where he noted that Marilyn was not who he thought she was and embarrassed him in front of his intellectual circle of friends. This revelation devastated Marilyn, who plummeted deeper into the throes of addiction. Her destructive habits continued to worsen from then on, hitting a new low after the miscarriage in 1957. Despite the mounting frustrations, there were moments of sheer genius born on the set. Jack Lemmon arrived one day to shoot a scene where he tells Tony Curtis's Joe of his engagement to Osgood Fielding, a local millionaire played to perfection by veteran character actor Joey Brown, that has fallen in love with Lemon's Daphne. He found Billy Wilder dancing with a pair of maracas, which he handed to Lemon, instructing him to gesticulate with them after delivering each of his lines. Lemon, who had blocked the scene out much differently and at an entirely different pace, was concerned that Wilder was ruining one of his best scenes. It wasn't until the film was released that Lemon understood Wilder's genius. The laughter from the audience was so overwhelming that they would have missed important dialogue had it not been for the brief breaks in between provided by the maracas. Marilyn's difficulty remembering her lines worsened with each day. In one scene between Sugar and Tony Curtis's fake millionaire, Junior, Marilyn was to point up at a mounted swordfish and ask, "What is it?" To which Curtis would reply, "It's a member of the herring family." Simple enough, but according to Tony Curtis, the scene took a week and a half to shoot because Marilyn couldn't remember her lines. During a preview of some of the rushes of the scene, Tony Curtis, who had the least amount of patience for Marilyn, stood up in front of the entire cast and crew, excluding Marilyn and Arthur Miller, and declared that kissing her was like kissing Hitler. Curtis would deny this statement in later years, but those who were there, including Jack Lemmon, confirmed that he did in fact make the remark. Billy Wilder weighed in at one point. "I had never met anyone as utterly mean as Marilyn Monroe, nor as utterly fabulous on the screen. She paid absolutely no attention to anybody. She never thought, 'We're doing 80 takes, and these guys are standing there cramping. They're not going to get any better. In fact, it may kind of curdle on us.' That's what Tony meant when he said it was like kissing Hitler." Though he could not deny the undue frustrations she caused on set, Jack Lemmon was far more forgiving of Marilyn than Tony Curtis was. "I liked her very much, and I got along great with her," Lemmon would say years later. "She had a lot of problems. She was basically an unhappy girl. She drove Billy and Tony crazy. She drove me a little crazy too, but I didn't let on, and it didn't bother me as much as it bothered them. And it was almost always the same thing. The lateness. She had a problem, God knows what it was. She just could not come out of her dressing room, fully made up and dressed in everything, until she was ready to face the cameras psychologically. Until then, you could knock on the door and she'd say, 'Fuck off.' Literally. She just could not and would not come out. Now and then, unfortunately, I think she was slugging off a bit of wine and stuff while she was sitting in there, and that didn't help, but it sure as hell didn't hurt her performances because she was wonderful." In the second half of the film, Tony had those longer scenes with her on the yacht and everything, while I'm off with a rose in my mouth, dancing with Joey Brown and having a ball. Tony and Billy were suffering. For a scene where Marilyn knocks on the door of the hotel room shared by Curtis and Lemon's female counterparts, Josephine and Daphne, all she had to say was, "It's me, Sugar." It took 47 takes and every single variation of those three words together, including such flubs as, "Sugar, it's me," before Marilyn got the line right. After take 30, Wilder had the line taped to the door, to no avail. In a similar situation, Marilyn was supposed to walk into their room and start rifling through a dresser, asking aloud, "Where's that bourbon?" After numerous failed takes, they finally resorted to writing the line on pieces of paper and sticking a copy in each drawer of the dresser. Even with this visual aid, it took Marilyn several takes to deliver the line correctly. In fact, it is speculated by film historians that Marilyn may never have gotten the line right. Since her back is to the camera when the line is delivered, her dialogue very well could have been dubbed in later on. Meanwhile, the scene where Tony Curtis as Junior meets Sugar for the first time had been allotted 3 shooting days as both Marilyn and Tony had complicated lines of dialogue. That scene was shot in only 20 minutes. Despite the headaches she may have caused, Wilder could not deny that Marilyn was perfect as Sugar, later saying, "If she gets the line out, absolutely perfect, perfect timing, the sound of her voice, she knew where the joke was. She was born with that kind of gift. Because you could have 50 actresses, and they can all be quite good, some even more. But nobody would have been better than her." Wilder hit the nail on the head. She certainly may have been difficult to work with, but Marilyn's performance was a career best, despite her worst professional behavior to date. She delivered her lines as only she could have delivered them. "Do you play the market?" Junior asks her. "No, the ukulele," Marilyn replies with flawless timing. Tony Curtis also demonstrates his range as an actor, juggling triple roles as Joe, the womanizing saxophone player, Josephine, his regal, man-hating female disguise, and Junior, the lonely millionaire heir to the Shell Oil fortune, and shuffling in and out of all three of them without missing a beat. With all the praise that is due to both Marilyn Monroe and Tony Curtis, Some Like It Hot undeniably belongs to Jack Lemmon. Lemmon's comically absurd, unabashed performance makes every second that he is on screen pure gold. It is plain to see that Lemmon was having a lot of fun with the character, and certainly had no qualms about dressing in women's clothing. He commits to the role and relishes in the opportunity to create a new identity. Where Tony Curtis's Josephine is withdrawn and low-key, Lemon's Daphne is chipper and flamboyant, taking on a life of her own as soon as she is deployed. Marilyn's behavior became more and more unpredictable as her pregnancy developed. She was both hopeful for and dreading this pregnancy. She wanted to have a baby and feared that the strain from the picture would cause her to miscarry. However, she continued to ignore the warnings of her gynecologist, Dr. Leon Krohn, who joined her on location, cautioning Marilyn that her excessive alcohol and prescription pill consumption could be detrimental to the health of her pregnancy. On October 21st, Marilyn was once again rushed to the hospital, fearing that she had miscarried. This time it was only a false alarm, but her doctors continued to warn her against drinking and taking pills. Scenes were rescheduled and shooting days were reworked to film around Marilyn while she took a week off to rest. On days when Marilyn was unavailable to work, top-tier gentlemen George Raft and Joey Brown never hesitated to fill in so as not to waste a shooting day. Raft, who was already in his early 60s at the time, even gave pointers to Brown and Jack Lemmon during their tango scene. Without the charm and lovable quality that was undeniable about Joey Brown, Osgood Fielding would have been just another dirty old man. But his performance, infused with naivete and aloofness, has us actually rooting for his romance with Daphne to work out. As the production was nearing its end, the only scene left to shoot was the film's final scene. The problem this time was that Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond hadn't finished writing it. They didn't get the bulk of the scene finished until the night before they were set to film it, and even by then, neither of them knew what the closing line would be. Billy Wilder would later say, "We needed a final line, a spleen-splitting belly laugh. I.A.L. Diamond suggested nobody's perfect. We weren't crazy about it, but it was late at night and we were pooped, so we decided, let's put it on paper, fully expecting to find something really funny when it came time to shoot the scene." That just goes to show you how little we know. The scene goes like this. It's the end of the film, and Joe has revealed himself as a man to Sugar, who loves him no matter what, even though he lied to her about being Junior and Josephine. Now Jerry, still dressed as Daphne, is trying to break off the engagement to Osgood, who won't back down. "I have a terrible past. For 3 years now, I've been living with a saxophone player," Daphne cries. "I forgive you," Osgood answers, unperturbed. Daphne looks up, forlorn, her voice cracking. "I can never have children." Osgood shrugs. "We can adopt some." "You don't understand, Osgood. Ugh." Now it's Jerry who groans, dropping his falsetto voice and yanking off his wig. "I'm a man." Without missing a beat, Osgood quips to Jerry's alarm, "Well, nobody's perfect," just as "the end" pops up on the screen. I.A.L. Diamond felt that the line worked because audiences would never see it coming. We like to be in on the joke, to feel the anticipation and know what's coming before it arrives. From the moment we learn that Osgood has fallen in love with Daphne, we know that at some point he's going to find out that she's actually Jerry. We expect there to be an explosion, not indifference. Within just a few days of the production ending in November, Billy Wilder had a final cut of the film. He threw a wrap party for the cast and crew, but did not extend an invitation to Marilyn. He would later tell the New York Herald Tribune, "Would I direct Marilyn again? I have discussed this with my doctor and my psychiatrist and my accountant. They tell me that I am too old and too rich to go through it again." When Arthur Miller sent Billy Wilder a strongly worded telegram once the picture wrapped, Wilder responded, "Had you, dear Arthur, been not her husband, but her writer and director, and been subjected to all the indignities I was, you would have thrown her out on her can, thermos bottle and all, to avoid a nervous breakdown. I did the braver thing. I had the nervous breakdown. What was intended to be a 50-day shoot amounted to more than 70 days by the production's end. Marilyn's absences accounted for 13 missed shooting days, taking the film $200,000 to $300,000 over budget. In a call with the accounting department at United Artists, producer Howard Mirisch said that although they hadn't done too bad financially, Miss Monroe is impossible to control. By the time the film was completed, United Artists was in the hole for $2.6 million. Marilyn refused to pose for any of the still photography for the film's promotional material, as she had gained weight from her pregnancy. Instead, Sandra Warner, one of the girls from the band, posed in Marilyn's costumes alongside Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. Marilyn's head was superimposed on Warner's body later on. With the picture completed, the success of Some Like It Hot, as well as the studio's chances to recoup their losses, depended entirely on the movie-going public. A preview screening was held in December 1958, just a month after the film wrapped. By all accounts, it was an absolute disaster. Jack Lemmon recalled that the audience had the worst reaction of any film I have ever been in. Only one person in the mostly middle-aged audience laughed, while the rest of the theatergoers shuffled awkwardly in their seats or collected their belongings and walked out of the showing. After the screening, the Mirisch brothers tried to convince Wilder that he needed to cut the film down to make it more suitable for release, arguing that at over 2 hours, it was too long for a comedy. The film also ran the risk of losing out on ticket sales from the more pious moviegoers, as it was being released without the seal of approval from the Motion Picture Production Code because of the inclusion of cross-dressing and suggested homosexuality. Wilder would cut only one scene from the film, where Marilyn stops by Tony Curtis's bunk on the train because she can't sleep due to someone snoring and the two switch beds. Jack Lemmon then sneaks down to what had been Sugar's bunk, revealing himself to be a man, only to find Curtis lying there instead. Lemmon slaps his wig back on and asks, "You wouldn't hit a girl, would you?" The only person who was not put off by the failed screening was Billy Wilder, who organized a second screening just a few days later on December 17th at the Westwood Village Theater, which catered to the young UCLA college student crowd. This was to be Some Like It Hot's final test. The Westwood screening was a massive success, with the audience howling throughout the entire picture. It gave the Mirisch brothers the assurance that they had made the right choice, and that the film would go on to do big business. Just one day before the Westwood showing, Marilyn Monroe suffered a miscarriage at 3 months pregnant. She would never conceive again. Some Like It Hot finally had its theatrical release on March 24, 1959, just 4 months after shooting finished. It went on to become one of the biggest films of the year, earning $13 million during its initial run. It held the number one spot at the box office for 3 straight weeks before being replaced by Lana Turner's Imitation of Life, which topped the list for 2 weeks before Some Like It Hot came back to claim the position, remaining at number one for another 4 weeks, eventually being knocked off by Porkchop Hill with Gregory Peck. Despite its success, the film was met with some controversy upon its release. It was condemned by the National Legion of Decency, a Catholic organization that took offense to the picture, which they deemed morally objectionable, and accused it of promoting homosexuality, lesbians, and transvestism. Additionally, after United Artists refused to cut Curtis and Monroe's love scene, the film was banned in Kansas. In Tennessee, a Memphis censorship board would only allow adults in to see the picture. Some Like It Hot went on to receive 6 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Jack Lemmon, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume Design. Unfortunately for Some Like It Hot, it was released the same year as Ben-Hur and The Diary of Anne Frank, both of which cleaned up the award ceremony. The film fared better at the Golden Globes, picking up trophies for Jack Lemmon and Marilyn Monroe, as well as one for Best Picture. Over the years, and certainly after Marilyn's death in 1962, the cast and crew members' opinions of her softened with time. "My Aunt Minnie would always be punctual and never hold up production," said Billy Wilder. "But who would pay to see my Aunt Minnie?" He was also quoted as saying, "I have no problem with Marilyn Monroe." Monroe had problems with Monroe. When it was all said and done, and my stomach got back to normal, it seemed well worth the agony of working with her. Never a week passes when I didn't wish she was still around. The problems, both personal and professional, that plagued the production are not evident when watching the film. More than 60 years later, Some Like It Hot is just as funny and well-crafted as it was upon its release, and continues to be discovered and beloved by each new generation. The American Film Institute even put it at number one on their list of the funniest American movies of all time. The film's final line tells us that nobody's perfect, but Some Like It Hot certainly comes close. Okay, there we have it. The making of Some Like It Hot. I hope you guys enjoyed my first foray into podcasting. I had a lot of fun doing it. Of course, my dog started snoring again around the 18-minute mark, so you can hear him in there. And what else do I want to say? I don't know how often I'm going to be doing these, because it takes me a while to do the research, and then compile the research, and then write the script. But maybe I'll do one more this month, try to get a Christmas movie in, since it is December. Oh, and if you're not already, please follow me on Instagram at ThePicturesGotSmall. I share Hollywood trivia on there every day, and lately I've been doing these little quizzes on my Instagram stories. Also, feel free to send me an email at ThePicturesGotSmallBusiness@gmail.com with any questions, comments, concerns, feedbacks, criticisms, movies you'd like me to cover in the future, whatever it is you'd like to say. All right, well, I guess I gotta end this somehow. Of all the podcasts on all the streaming platforms, on all the smartphones in all the world, I'm certainly glad you found mine. Right? Huh? How was that? Okay, for real this time. I'm Francesca Luisi, and this has been The Pictures Got Small.
Oh, why did I have to fall in love with such a fool?
I ran into a story for you, a front page story.
Gus, you're a dear, sweet boy, and you'll bring my little present.
I happen to know the police are looking for this car.
Oh, dear, I hoped you wouldn't.
You heard me say no, didn't you? Well, that's what I mean.
See here, I told you I wasn't asking anything from anybody. I can take care of myself.
Maybe you have, but if you think I want to stay cooped up in this place any longer than I have to.
Well, this is one of the biggest stories that's cracked in a long time. I've simply got to get it to my paper.
No hurry about that. We've got all the time in the world.
Thank you for listening to The Pictures Got Small. Remember, Hollywood was glamorous and sometimes dark.